we're discussing our state's juvenile justice system and focusing on Milwaukee County here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Governor Evers' biennial budget proposal calls for changes to how youth are sentenced and receive treatment. It proposes nearly $46 million for a new juvenile facility in Milwaukee. This July, it was the original date set to close the Northwoods Youth Prisons, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. How do you feel about the delay to close them? What do you think of community-based facilities instead that focused on trauma-informed care and mental health? 800-642-1234. Mark Mertens is administrator of the Division of Youth and Family Services for Milwaukee County. He's part of a nationwide group called Youth Correctional Leaders for Justice. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start with your county and then we'll zoom out to the state. Give us an assessment of what juvenile justice looks like now in Milwaukee County, where you are at with, you know, youth and families in the system.
Sure. Well, we receive right now about, I'd say a three-year average would be about 1,500 referrals a year from law enforcement of youth ages 10 to 17 that have committed what would, if they had committed the offense as an adult, would be considered a crime. So we call it delinquency in the juvenile justice system. We receive those referrals and we work with those youth through the local justice system. At any given time, we have about 400 youth that are on supervision here in Milwaukee County, on court-ordered supervision, typically. So just a little context for around the numbers. We've been really on a journey over the last, at least the last 5 years, to really align our practices with the science of adolescent brain development and with what we know through research works around delivering youth justice services. We've worked hard to reduce the number of youth that are in correctional facilities. I think we've reduced by about 80% over the last 5 years.
Wow.
Yes.
That's significant.
Thank you. We're still on a journey to continue to reduce. We're down. Last week we sort of hit a milestone. We had less than 20 youth in Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake County committed youth. I'll draw a finer point on that distinction later on. That's down from about 120 back in the beginning of 2016. So. We're below 20. We think we can get to zero by the end of the year as we continue to develop a more robust continuum of services here in the county to serve those youth. So I'm very encouraged by that. And we want to continue to push forward and find a better way to serve our youth locally.
How has the pandemic affected your work or the number of referrals or what you're able to do with these youth and families?
Referrals are actually, we're actually down in 2020. I think the pandemic had some impact overall on crime, youth crime, especially. However, if you've been watching the trends in Milwaukee, you would see that violent crime overall is up. And I'm not just speaking of juveniles or youth, rather. I'm really talking about overall violent crime. Homicides are up. I think we're going to come close to doubling the rate of homicides when all the figures come in for 2020. Domestic violence is up. So the type and seriousness of offenses is up. And I think anecdotally, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think that is probably true for youth as well, that those types of serious crimes are up. Youth that have been victims of serious crime and youth that commit serious crimes are up, even though the overall number of referrals to us for committing offenses is down about 25% over 2019.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Mark Mertens, who is administrator for Milwaukee County's Youth and Family Services Division. We're talking about the status of juvenile justice in the county, overall trends that he sees, and what diversion looks like. You can join in with your questions. How do you feel about eliminating the Serious Juvenile Offender Program? What kind of alternatives do you think should be used instead of incarcerating youth? 800-642-1234. Mark, you know, when you look around the state, do you think what you're describing in Milwaukee County is reflective of the state of youth justice for Wisconsin as a whole, or do you see wide ranges in how youth and families are treated around the state, rural versus urban, perhaps?
Well, I think there are differences in within, you know, the 72 counties. Each county in Wisconsin has its own youth justice system because mm-hmm. they're all operated by counties. And I think there's a wide range of resources available within counties for youth justice. I think in general, most of the youth justice leaders in our state are really beginning to align themselves with the science of serving youth, adolescents, and their brain development, and establishing developmentally appropriate responses to youth crime. I think they're all working in that direction to varying degrees. And again, some of that is related to the resources that they have or don't have. I'm optimistic about that. I think there's pretty strong alignment with the science here in Wisconsin. I think our policies need to also align with the science, our laws and our policies around youth justice. And I think the governor's proposal is a really really encouraging step. I think
Let's dig into the governor's proposal and what you see in that 2-year spending plan, because there are significant changes to the overall criminal justice system, but especially juvenile justice. What do you see?
Sure. Well, I'm very encouraged by the emphasis on community-based programming, especially because that's what's most effective, is serving youth in their own community, where they can establish supports, where they can practice the new skills that they've learned, and so on. So I'm very encouraged by that. I'm also encouraged by the position that the governor is taking about essentially eliminating youth prisons. And now, that does not mean that there aren't some youth that, for community safety purposes, need to be separated from the community for a period of time. That's, I think, always going to be necessary. But our approach is antiquated. Prisons are antiquated. I think probably all of your listeners are aware of the very serious issues that occurred at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake School, the abuses that occurred there, and the lack of education and lack of treatment that has historically been provided there really does not bode well for proper developmental treatment of youth and proper rehabilitation. We can do much better than that, and we intend to do much better. We are doing much better, and we intend to do even better locally. And I think the governor's proposal supports that. So I'm very encouraged.
We're talking with Mark Mertens, administrator of the Division of Youth and Family Services for Milwaukee County. We're discussing how his county is reducing the number of local youth who are incarcerated, what he envisions for juvenile justice going forward in his community. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mark Mertens here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at how Milwaukee County is dramatically reducing the number of youth who are incarcerated at Lincoln Hills and what diversion alternatives are working and why. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Efforts have stalled to close the Northwoods Youth Prison. Lincoln Hills has 54 youth in its facility in its most recent weekly census. Copper Lake has 6. How do you think the state should deal with juvenile offenders? 800-642-1234. Mark Mertens is administrator of the Milwaukee County Youth and Family Services Division, and he stays with us. Let's bring in Lisa now in Madison. Hi, Lisa. What is your perspective?
Hi. I was really disturbed, as most people were, regarding what was happening at Lincoln Hills. And in the mid-90s, I worked at a youth correction facility in northwestern Wisconsin. Quite a few kids from Milwaukee County were actually sent there. And on a daily basis, I witnessed staff who would escalate children into violence and then use that violence to justify further consequences or punishment, really. And, I reported that to the management of the facility many times, and nothing was ever done. And, in fact, I was sometimes the one written up. So, very disturbed to see that not a lot had changed in the intervening years in these facilities. And I hope that there is genuine change going forward, because those children deserve much better.
Lisa, thank you for sharing your experience in the 90s. What impact does staff training have on the work you do and how you work with these juveniles and families? Mark?
Thank you, Lisa. And I'm really sorry to hear about your experiences. And I wish I could say that your experiences were atypical, but they are not atypical. And that they do reflect the type of practice that has occurred historically. So we are being very intentional about assuring that that our staff are trained. We've made significant changes, especially in the juvenile detention center in Milwaukee, the Vell Phillips Juvenile Detention Center. We've reduced over the course of time, over the past 5 years or so, we've reduced the incidence of use of force by about, I think it's about 80% in that time. And a lot of that has to do with staff training. Selecting staff that have an interest in working with youth, helping youth, don't see themselves necessarily as correctional officers, although that certainly is part of their job. They're responsible for safety in the facility and so on, but that they don't see that as the core of who they are professionally. Would they get trained in de-escalation? We emphasize verbal de-escalation over physical restraint, and we've made significant changes. And I think that Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake are on a similar path. I'm encouraged by the new leadership there that's been in place for the last couple of years. They are colleagues that I've worked with for a long time and that I trust. I think they're doing their best to achieve similar changes there around reducing the use of force and so on. It's a challenge. Changing culture is a challenge within an institution like Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake. That's always very challenging. But I think Lisa outlines all of the reasons why it's necessary to close youth prisons in general and to have a new approach, a better approach that's more humane and more developmentally appropriate.
Can you talk a bit more about the use of restraint, when it's used, and what that means?
Well, it should really only be used in an incident where a youth is in the process of harming someone else or themselves. In those cases, officers would employ restraint techniques that they've been trained in to provide the least amount of force necessary to prevent the youth from hurting themselves or hurting other people. So there's a whole training process. Every time there's a use of restraint or use of force within our facility, most of it is, first of all, is you know, seen on camera, because we have security cameras all over the detention center. But all incidents are reviewed by supervisors, and you know, we look at did the officer follow their training? Did they follow proper procedure to call in support, and so on? So we're very mindful of doing things the right way and preventing injuries. And again, as I mentioned, we've reduced these types of incidents by over 80%. So that really tells you, first, it tells you two things. First of all, it tells you that historically those techniques were overused. And secondly, it tells you that if you treat youth with respect, you listen to them, and you use the types of verbal de-escalation techniques that you're trained in, that's effective, and that's the direction we should go. That should be our default. And so use of force should be an absolute last resort.
We're talking with Mark Mertens, who is administrator for the Milwaukee County Youth and Family Services Division. He's a member of the group Youth Correctional Leaders for Justice that seeks to close youth prisons in the U.S. Taking your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Colin is joining us from Wausau. Hi, Colin. What would you like to ask?
Appreciate the call. Appreciate your work. Appreciate the program and stuff like that. Couple things. My question is about the investment that we're going to put into education and giving the skills to help the people that are in correctional facilities when they get out to be or to have a better opportunity to stay in society and not to go back. There's a great restaurant in Cleveland, Ohio called Edwin's. A guy, Brandon, is the CEO, and it's Education Wins, and he takes in inmates or others and teaches them culinary skills so that they can leave with a skill set and then make a living. There's a Netflix series called College in the Prisons that's phenomenal. And I'm an educator, and I would love to listen to how can I help in the summers? What could I do locally in Wausau, near or far, to help education be the way out?
Colin, thank you.
Colin, that is exactly spot on around the type of approach we need to take and the type of work that we're trying to do in the community in Milwaukee. We're working right now on a couple of actually culinary arts projects for youth. So you hit it right on the head. But we're also looking at other opportunities for apprenticeships or vocational training and so on. We're trying to work very closely with our community and in a different way than we have previously. Typically, it's been a sort of a top-down approach where, you know, we come up with solutions within the department or, you know, within government, and then we look for agencies to implement those solutions. We want to change that around, where we want to be inquiring from a more sort of horizontal grassroots perspective along with the community to find solutions. There are some amazing people in Milwaukee that are very committed to working with youth that are all around within our community. And we're trying to really capitalize on that, work with those people directly and work with them on finding the solutions that are right in our community. Much of that does have to do with education, as you mentioned, and with providing the opportunities and the right supports so that youth can succeed.
Something you've said before and told your kids really sticks with me, and it's something I will tell mine when they're older. You've said you don't want to put yourself in a position where you make one mistake that you can never undo. How common is it with the youth you work with where it was one mistake, one very bad decision that unraveled a young life?
Unfortunately, it's much more prevalent than any of us would like to see. This is high stakes work. There are There are youth that make very bad decisions, very dangerous decisions, and sometimes it results in loss of life or injury, and those are things that can never be undone. So we feel the urgency of all of that, and we want to try to help our youth to not make those kinds of decisions that they can never undo. Most things are fixable, right? Most bad decisions that we make. Think back, at least I'll self-disclose and say I can think back to my own life and say, man, I made some bad decisions. But most of those things, I mean, they're in the past now. They were undone. But there are certain things that can't be undone. And we don't want our youth to be subject to those unfixable mistakes.
Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Mark Mertens is administrator for the Division of Youth and Family Services in Milwaukee County, member of the Youth Correctional Leaders for Justice. Ahead this hour, it's analysis on last week's wolf hunt with the head of the UW Carnivore Coexistence Lab. We'll pick up the conversation after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about the first woman to win the Iditarod sled dog race.
Since 1973, the Iditarod Trail sled dog race has brought together humans and dogs. They work together, traversing nearly 1,000 miles of brutal conditions across the frozen landscapes of the Alaskan tundra. Author Matt Geiger shares the story of Wisconsin native Libby Riddles, the first woman to win this world-renowned race.
You know, so with dog racing, I think we all say you could have your highest and lowest moments in your entire life out there because it's so intense.
That's Libby Riddles talking with me on the phone from Alaska. In 1985, she was 30 miles from the Iditarod finish line, in the belly of a heavy storm in the dark of night. Riddles and her dogs took a wrong turn. Unable to see more than a few feet in front of them, they ran on, unknowingly dashing away from the Bering Sea into the interior of the Alaskan wilderness, exhausted and running away from the finish line. Out of the night, Riddles saw a small cluster of houses. All were dark, but for one. She rode toward that single beacon of light. She stopped her sled, walked up to the home, and asked the man who appeared in the doorframe, that fragile symbolic portal between the domestic and atavistic spheres, a simple question. Where am I? He pointed her in the right direction and said goodbye. She was still in the lead. Riddle's headlamp was almost completely dead, and in the primal darkness she headed back through the night, she, her team of huskies, and their sled surging forward as a single unit, flying toward the finish line. Riddles was not the first woman to complete the last great race. She was the first to win it. This soft-spoken woman, who was shy in her youth and who did not set out into the world with any great ambitions beyond living and working with animals, had done something never done before. Far from the modern world, far from its paradoxical combination of comforts and concerns, she and her animals had traversed some of the harshest terrain on Earth, covering nearly 1,000 miles, besting every other competitor.
I mean, the moment when I won the Iditarod is going to be a pretty hard moment to beat ever in my whole life, really. One of my less famous quotes was, if I die now, it'll be okay, because that was just spontaneously what it felt like. It's like, wow.
I feel like it's if I die now, it's okay.
Riddle started life in Madison, Wisconsin. From there, her family moved to La Crosse, where she has fond memories of the bluffs and the thunderstorms. She says the Midwest was a great training ground for what was to come later.
To me, it seems a pretty universal thing. Animals are very calming, especially dogs in a way, because, they've actually co-evolved along with us for so many thousands and thousands of years. And yet, they're kind of like a bridge between the wild animals and humans.
Today, Riddles lives in the Alaskan bush outside Homer. In the summer, she picks berries and makes jam, some of which she will trade with friends and neighbors for moose and salmon. She doesn't use a computer often, and her phone only works in one particular corner of her house. Even there, her voice flickers, coming and going, like visions of the trail on a winter night, as she and her dogs pushed on, happy and undaunted by the darkness around them.
A kid, I was, a kid who's kind of shy of people sometimes, except for maybe my close circle. And, animals seem so much less complicated to deal with, I guess, in a way than people. I don't know. It's just, it kind of keeps people easier to deal with if you're around animals too, I guess.
Matt Geiger is a journalist and the author of Raised by Wolves and other books. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
And now we debrief on last week's wolf hunt as hunters and trappers in our state far exceeded the statewide limit, killing 216 gray wolves and causing the DNR to end the season 4 days early. What role do wolves have in our landscape? Are you worried about wolves coming onto your property? What steps have you taken to deter them? Do you think hunting threatens the state's wolf population? It's 800-642-1234. Adrian Trevis is an environmental studies professor at UW-Madison's Nelson Institute. He founded the Carnivore Coexistence Lab. Adrian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for inviting me.
Were you surprised that the quota was exceeded so quickly?
No, that was entirely predictable because of the rules of the hunt that don't respond quickly enough to filling a particular zone's quota, and a lot of social media chatter about exceeding the quota by wolf haters.
So tell us about the wolf population and what you know. I mean, is it difficult to understand how many packs there are, how many wolves there are in the state?
Yeah, it's super difficult, Kate. And part of the problem is that this is the first time we've ever held a hunt during January and February, which is the wolves' mating season. This is when alpha males and females bond and mate and hopefully produce a litter of pups. The hunt occurring at this time is likely to have killed a lot of alpha males and females. And we have basically zero scientific information about the success of reproduction moving forward in 2021. On top of that, the snow-covered months like January and February are super important for wolf census. So you can basically throw away the data from January to all the way from December, January, February on the wolf count. All those data are now called into question because we don't know if a wolf that was counted back then was killed during the hunt. So my lab has made some efforts to estimate how bad the carnage was, and it's not just the legal reported kill, but all of the unreported poaching that would have happened at the same time.
And I would assume also the natural mortality life cycle.
100%, Kate. Yeah. So the high population size for the wolves was last May, let's say, and the official state estimate, the lower range of it was 1,034 wolves. They don't produce any pups after that period. Well, to be accurate, the 1,034 was adults in May. We can estimate how many pups were born, but then it's a continuous case of draining that resource. And then the hunt is on top of it, sacrificing future reproduction. So we are a little bit fumbling in the dark. We have to rely on mathematical models to predict where we are now and where we're going to be come November. And it's a bleak picture.
In terms of packs, the DNR said that there were 256 packs at the end of last year. What do you see?
Well, that's the information we have, and we don't have any additional information, but we can make projections based on the research using the official numbers, even though those aren't peer-reviewed. We've added on top of it our peer-reviewed research from Dr. Guillaume Chaperon and myself, and Dr. Francisco Santiago Avila, Dr. Rick Chappelle, UW-Madison, and myself. And we've made some projections that suggest over 100 wolves would have been poached at the same time as the legal hunting was going on. And that's a actually conservative estimate, because this hunt was unprecedented in its use of snowmobiles, its use of nighttime hunting, the use of hounds, which is probably leading to hound fighting with wolves, which is illegal animal fighting. And that all contributes to an uncertainty. I'd say the minimum estimate is about 115 wolves were poached and undetected by law enforcement, who's had its teeth pulled over the years.
We heard from Rana, called from Cameron and couldn't stay with us, wants to ask you, Rana had heard about the 216 wolves being harvested, and curious, Rana asks, if this includes wolves harvested by Native Americans in Wisconsin. Can you explain that data a little bit more?
Oh, sure. Thanks for the question, Rana. I mean, I don't have the specifics. So there's a legal quota. There was a legal quota that might have included tribal members living outside of reservation. But the Ojibwe tribal nations of Wisconsin have declined to kill wolves. They tried to reserve, I believe it was 81. They tried to reserve 81 wolves out of the quota to protect them as living wolves, as is their right by federal treaty. And it's my understanding they did not kill any wolves because they view Maingan, that's what they call the wolf, as brother or companion in their creation story.
We heard from Matt and Wassa sent us an email saying that this massive overharvest of our shared natural resource makes Matt want to cry, and says, we let a small minority of our population kill a quarter of our wolves in 60 hours. And Matt wonders, you know, what does this mean for the future?
Yeah, Matt, I hear you. The only thing I would add is that they actually killed more than a quarter because of this unreported poaching. And listen, if we call ourselves a state with science-based wildlife management, we've just made a laughingstock of ourselves across the nation and across the world, because the science behind this hunt is basically missing in action. And instead, a narrow minority started calling the shots. So there's a very real risk that we are jeopardizing the stability and security of our wolf population across the state. There's a very real risk of jeopardizing the truly legitimate wolf hunting season that would have started the November of 2021. And there's a risk that wolves get relisted by federal courts because of the behavior of a handful of Wisconsin hunters.
We have UW-Madison Environmental Studies Professor Adrian Trevis, who leads the Carnivore Coexistence Lab. Are you worried that a wolf hunting season will lead to the extinction of gray wolves in Wisconsin? What concerns you? Have you seen a gray wolf in the wild? What was the encounter like? Have you lost livestock to wolves? How did it affect your farm? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Adrian Trevis here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with UW-Madison Environmental Studies Professor Adrian Trevis. The hunt last week was the first to take place during the gray wolf's breeding season, and the DNR says the vast majority of wolves were hunted with dogs. How do you feel about that? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Adrian Trevis is with us for 10 more minutes. Adrian, Wisconsin's Act 169 sets the rules for wolf hunting and trapping. It's the state law governing the annual wolf hunt. What does a fair chase mean in hunting down these wolves?
I don't actually know. That's not a scientific term. It's something that's thrown around by hunters who want to either be ethical or seem ethical. So that's a value-based statement about how hunting would be conducted. I think what's behind your question might be this issue of the vast number of wolves killed by hounds or houndsmen. And I think your listeners need to understand that these are large, aggressive dogs released and often kilometers away from their owners. Their owners can be sitting in their trucks tracking their dogs with radio telemetry equipment. The dogs are running all over tarnation. They aren't trained effectively to just home in on some targets. So they're likely to be harming other wildlife, including endangered species. And they're likely to get into fights with wolves, including targeting the alphas preferentially during the winter when the alpha male and female are urinating and leaving some blood in the snow because the female is ovulating. She's sexually receptive. That's an especially attractive trail for the hounds. So it's very likely that every pack that encountered hounds lost its alphas and therefore won't breed next year.
How do wolves react to being attacked by hunting dogs?
Well, I know how the law enforcement system of Wisconsin should react. It's illegal. Animal fighting is illegal. It's against statute. And the owners of those hounds should be taken to court on that basis. We don't know how the wolves react. I imagine it's horrible. If I had to put myself in their position, sounds like an absolute nightmare. And typically, we expect wildlife to flee those hounds until the point where they're exhausted and can't run anymore. And at that point, we expect fighting to occur. We know many hounds get injured, and so we expect more wolves are getting injured and killed because these packs of hounds can be released. They can number six when they're released. And the average wolf pack size in Wisconsin is four in late winter.
Let's bring in Kathy now in Whitefish. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate the show, and I appreciate that you have a scientist on. My concern is really that, to a great extent, the problem that we seem to have here is a governance problem. My understanding from news accounts of this hunt is that the DNR staff recommended that a smaller number of permits be issued and that the board significantly increased the number of permits. And so, and then, of course, we have DNR spokespeople saying that they regret the number of wolves that were killed. So it seems like the DNR board has put the staff in a position of having administered a hunt that they couldn't control. And the rest of us citizens are left seeing that this has happened in our state with no recourse and also no real reason to think that this won't happen again.
Kathy,
I appreciate the science focus of this discussion, but I'm wondering if your guest can speak to how we can have a way that science can infuse decisions going forward about this. And frankly, I'm not very optimistic.
Kathy, thank you. And the state did sell 1,547 permits for this hunt, Adrian.
Yeah, thanks. I think Kathy's hit the nail on the head. And I would ask Governor Evers to appoint an independent scientific panel to completely overhaul the wolf science behind the future management plan. And that process for overhauling the science needs to be done separate from the political pressures and influences of interest groups, which is not the current plan, as I understand it, from the DNR's call for their management planning committee. The reason that we need the scientists to be independent is so that they're not strongly influenced by undue political pressures or interest group preferences, but they simply weigh what do we know, what do we need to know, and bring the best available science to the political bodies that are going to make those decisions about quotas. So I think Kathy from Whitefish has hit the nail on the head that we have a problem of governance. Governor Evers can fix it with the stroke of a pen, and I'm calling on him to do that. We need independent science, and then we need a process that is transparent about the values that political groups and interest groups are bringing to the table.
And the DNR has said it's forming a wolf advisory committee to develop new quota recommendations for a hunt in November.
Yeah, listen, I hate to be a Debbie Downer, but the process they've articulated is going to make scientists like myself sidelined and forced to argue with politicians and interest groups about values, which is not our role as scientists. We're supposed to be evaluating the evidence based on accepted scientific standards. And we argue amongst ourselves as scientists, but we know how to come to consensus based on transparent standards of evidence. Then we present the evidence to the interest groups and decision makers and the public so they go through the political process. It has to be done in two steps separate from each other. Otherwise, you get the kind of mess we had in February.
Let's bring in Linda in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment about, Kate, your use of the word harvest. I know it's a common practice to use that word, but I read it online a comment recently, and I agree with it completely, that we harvest crops and we use them for purposes. I don't know anybody, or I've never heard of anybody, who kills a wolf to eat it, or to use it for really any positive purpose, other than possibly, which I don't think is very positive, is to have it stuffed. And I think that the word harvest is nothing more than a really nice euphemism for the word kill, which is actually what people who are killing wolves are doing.
Linda, thank you. Linda saying, you know, harvest being a sterile word, but what happens to a wolf carcass when a hunter kills the animal, Adrian?
Hey, hats off to you, Linda, for catching a euphemism that's hiding what's actually happening. Wolves are a public trust legacy for future generations. We are simply the trustees. And there's a very small minority of the population with lots of out-of-staters who would like to kill wolves for whatever they call it. It doesn't matter, whatever use they use it, they use that wolf for. It's going against the will of the vast majority of Wisconsin residents and U.S. residents. And U.S. residents have a say in this by Supreme Court rules since 1842. Wildlife are a legacy for the public, current and future generations. So thanks for that question, Linda.
Jeremy in southern Wisconsin. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Good morning. Yeah, I was just curious, you know, this conversation is very one-sided. I just want to say I'm not a wolf hunter. I have no desire to hunt wolves. However, like you're saying that we don't really have the science to back up the numbers and what they'll do. So the current population estimate that's being given is probably not that accurate. And I think we all agree that wolves are extremely intelligent animals. And do you think we could really kill 25% of the wolf population in Wisconsin in 2 days?
Adrian?
Hey, Jeremy, thanks for, I appreciate your courteous and civil tone. And the question actually might be rephrased as, if the official death toll was 219 and our models suggest another 115 were poached cryptically, the question really should be, what is that percentage of the wolf population in February? And unfortunately, the answer is we don't know. So I do think there's a tremendous risk that we killed a very high proportion of the wolf population. But really, we're only going to know that if we do good science now and into the future. And you can take an optimistic position on the death rate. That's what the DNR has done. Or you can take a cautious approach, which is what I've done.
Adrian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Adrian Trevis is an environmental studies professor at UW-Madison's Nelson Institute. He founded the Carnivore Coexistence Lab. Just ahead, stick with us. We look at the next phase of the COVID vaccination rollout, learn about Johnson & Johnson's newly approved one-shot vaccine. Can you get a vaccine appointment? Is there something you want to know about the J&J vaccine? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.